I called to order HSS 130 on the 23rd of February. All members are present. Senator Dyson, Senator Passban, Senator Elson, Ellis, and Senator Thomas, and myself, Betty Davis. We have two bills coming before us today. They are previous bills that have been heard. We're going to start off with the rate review bill. Okay, would you state your name for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Max Hensley, staff to Senator Ellis. Senator.
So it is a CS before us, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I guess I need to ask for that to be.
Well, Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, I was going to make some comments about the bill and then.
Before we get to that?
Right, and then Mr. Hensley was prepared to go through the.
That would be
committee substitute
fine.
That you
I
all.
I have no problem.
May choose to entertain.
Yes, Senator Ellis, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing the bill back before the committee. Just to remind folks, we had the first hearing about 3 weeks ago, and in that intervening time, we've been having discussions with my staff, Commissioner Hogan and his staff, input from Senator Davis's staff, with the goal of finding a way to implement the goals of the legislation while respecting the administrative difficulties the department might have in minimizing overhead costs. So that's really what we've been working on and want to bring before the committee today. I want to take a minute just to reestablish for the record the intent of the language that home and community-based services are the key, I've always thought that, to improving the quality of life of seniors and people, especially children with developmental disabilities. And I know there are key campaign folks, you noted that as well as I did today, Madam Chair, that folks are coming in today and this evening to advocate for the key campaign, and we appreciate that. It's been conclusively proven to replace home and community-based care can help replace or ameliorate the need for institutional care and do so at a lower cost to the state, not just on an individual case level but across the whole system, and we have the data to back that up. A recent study in the academic journal Health Affairs found that states with long-established high proportions of home and community-based services spending saw a 3% overall decrease in long-term care spending between 1995 and 2005, as opposed to a 14.5% increase in states that have a low proportion of home and community-based services to the overall means of care. According to the Department of Health and Social Services, Medicaid spending in Alaska is projected to reach $3.6 billion in 2028, so that's down the road. Per enrollee spending is projected to go from 7,400 to 22,000. Long-term care is projected to be the fastest growing segment of those services. And Department of Health and Social Services reports suggest that home and community-based services are the reason that institutional spending is projected to be relatively flat over the years 2008 to 2028. So that's not an attack or an affront on our wonderful nursing home facilities, long-term care facilities in the state of Alaska. It just means that, I just mean to emphasize the point that home and community-based services are the least restrictive level of care and the most cost-effective. So we'll need both. We'll need the continuum of care, but home and community-based services make all the sense in the world from a human perspective and from a budget perspective. And as we know, policy choices have a significant impact on these projections. We can control this growth with a wise allocation of current resources. Department of Health and Social Services and the legislature together, as you'll remember, hired Myers and Stouffer consultants to provide recommendations for home and community-based service methodologies. There is a broad acknowledgement that the current system is broken. The department wants to do better. They appreciate legislative guidance in this regard. Except for an across-the-board 4% jump in 2008, most providers haven't seen increases since 2004. Many haven't seen increases in 10 years, and it's just gotten to the breaking point. Serious problems in the contractor's methodology, and this is admitted by folks up front, left out testimony from most of the smaller providers that this bill is aimed at helping. This legislation specifically gives the department the flexibility to devise a cost-based system that works. That's a long-anticipated goal from the department itself, while fixing the disparity between home and community-based services and institutional care rates. Hospitals and nursing homes have statutorily defined methodology and required rate review, and it's a simple question. Why shouldn't home and community-based service providers in the state of Alaska, who are licensed by the state of Alaska and appreciated by all of us in serving this vulnerable population, why shouldn't home and community-based service providers deserve the same treatment by the state? And I think I've come to the conclusion, and many more folks are moving toward the conclusion, that there really is no logical reason why we shouldn't have regular rate review for the home and community-based services. So that's the rationale, Madam President. Thank you for letting me state that for the record. And when you're ready, if it's your desire, Mr. Hensley can fill us in on some of the details.
Okay. Mr. Passman, would you bring CS?
I would move that we would bring before this Health and Social Services Committee the committee substitute for Senate Bill 32, captioned under Work Draft 26-LS0218/C.
Any objection? Hear no objection.
Thank you. Again, my name is Max Hensley. I'm staff to Senator Ellis. I'll just speak briefly on some of the changes that were made, as Senator Ellis said, in these last few weeks of discussion between our office, your office, Madam Chair, and the department. There's four major changes between the original backslash R version and this CS, which is backslash C, I think everyone has in front of them. The first is to move the bill. It's location in statute. Previously amended Alaska Statute 4707-070 and 074. This takes these amendments out of those sections and creates a new section of statute 4707-069. This is at the request of the department to give them the flexibility to interpret the bill in a way that is more appropriate for the many small providers as opposed to the lengthy and specific history of litigation with the sections that were previously being amended.
Madam Chair, on that point,
if yes. I could.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to restate that this was easy to do, or this change that's proposed in the CS was easy to do. It, I believe, dealt with the concern of the hospital and nursing home folks from their long litigated portion of the statutes. We're putting the home and community-based services in a different section, so because it was never my intent to in any way impinge or affect in any way what's going on currently with nursing homes.
Yes,
the original drafting, as the senator said, as the sponsor said, was the result of a legal difference of interpretation, and this is an easy change that is maintains the language that was originally proposed, but does it without impacting these other sections of statute. The second change was also supported by the department. It adds the...
Would you state the page and the
yes.
lines that they're up, please?
We're looking here at page 1, lines 8 through 12. It adds to the provision of home and community-based waiver services two other categories of service. The provision of personal care services in a recipient's home, lines 8 and 9, and lines 10 and 11, assisted living homes for needy or vulnerable persons. Those are the other two categories which were studied in the Myers and Stouffer report that the sponsor referenced earlier. On page 2 and 3, sections 2 and 3 of the bill, our conforming language to change the references for assisted living homes to match the fact that their rates are now being determined by this new process of rate review as opposed to the older process, which was a minimum of $70 with the department's ability to adjust in regulation. So this just reflects the fact that the two sections are being referenced. On page 3, section 4 of the bill, page 3, lines 12 through 26, The department will give to the legislature a report on the trends in rates over the, this will be an annual report to be given each of the next 5 years to help keep the legislature informed with what this rate review process is doing to the rates and how it's being implemented and received. The report will be provided to the presiding officers of each house, the chairs of the two finance committees, and the chairs of the two health and social service committees, so that the folks with jurisdiction over this area will be kept informed. After Section 5 repeals this report after 5 years, at which point the program, if it is accepted in this legislation, will be well established. Finally, Section 6 is one last change made in consultation with the department. It's a 2-year delayed effective date, which allows the department to spend the intervening time to develop a methodology for determining costs in a way that will work with the small providers. As the sponsor discussed earlier, that has proven difficult in the past with the Myers and Stouffer report. So this gives them time to develop that. And that's the changes that were made in between our last meeting and today.
Okay, I thank you for that. Would you give me, just tell me exactly if this bill is to pass in its form, exactly what are we doing? What's going to happen? I know about the 2-year delay and all the other things that you said, but what's going to be different with this bill than what we already have?
Yes, Madam Chair. The list of changes I went through earlier was the changes that were made from the original bill to this committee substitute. The language of the bill itself remains unchanged. It's moved from section to a different section, but the bill requires the Department of Health and Social Services to review the rates paid through Medicaid to the providers of home and community-based services, as well as the other two categories that I spoke about earlier, to review them based on costs so that the providers are paid a rate that reflects the actual cost of providing those services, and to do that annually.
So with this bill, it will not give a rate increase in year 2010?
No, to the chair. The bill does not take effect until July 2011, and in any future rates will be determined by this review. It's, I think, in the opinion of the sponsor, early to determine whether or not what will happen to the rates. I think that they will probably increase, but there's no way of saying how much because it's been so long since any comprehensive study of this sort has been done.
All right, thank you. Any questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was probably reading when I should have been paying closer attention, I guess. But I see the fiscal notes indicate increases in 2010. Are those based on different provisions being put in place at different times is what it amounts to, I'm assuming. So,
through the chair, Senator Thomas, the fiscal notes refer to the original version of the bill. I see there's some folks from the department here who may be able to speak to how the proposed CS would change those fiscal notes. But in our discussions with them, a major reason for this new version is to lower those administrative and overhead costs that you see.
And just to put my follow-up, then it isn't phased in. It's all effective at one point in time. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
That's what I thought was the case, so I thought maybe I'd missed something. Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members at this time? We do have administration here, and I see Mr. Sherwood. Would you like to come forward, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm John Sherwood, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak. The department has been working with the committee and the sponsor to try and come to some understanding about the best way to move forward with this. We do want to improve our rate-setting methodology. A number of our concerns are addressed in the committee substitute. I think we still are concerned about the specificity of how to do rate setting actually being put in statute, and that may be an area where we simply continue to have a disagreement about. But with regard to the fiscal notes, the way this bill has been restructured, we would not expect the same kind of administrative cost either factored into the rate the providers pay to do the more expensive Medicare cost reporting, or factored into our audits and review of those cost reports. So while we haven't had an opportunity to recalculate our fiscal notes, we would expect a substantial decrease in the amount. And because this has a delayed effective date, of course, we wouldn't be seeing immediate expenditures or FY10 expenditures with regard to the rate increase.
And so the department will be submitting to us a zero fiscal note based upon what's in this particular bill?
Madam Chair, not zero fiscal note through the life of it. And there may be some small administrative expenses we would need to start this year in order to be able to implement and bring an effective rate setting system up at the proposed new effective date. So, but again, I apologize. We haven't had a chance to recalculate our fiscal notes yet based on the committee substitute.
Okay, thanks. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not remembering the stuff that came up in the earlier hearing, but to the administration, what would the administration prefer to be different in the rate setting mechanism?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, I think we really our rate setters and our lawyers get very uncomfortable about putting the specific requirements in about exactly what has to go into a rate. We don't mind having to do the regulations, to do the rates, and subject them to some sort of annual review, but just the kind of specific language about exactly what we have to look at when we calculate the rates. Our attorneys always get nervous when that goes into statute, because it's one more place for people to argue about what the legislature meant.
And if I may continue?
Yes, you may.
I can appreciate that. Is the administration concerned that this puts the review and the changing of the rates kind of on autopilot and out of the administration's control?
Through the chair, I think we are concerned that it would definitely restrict our ability to constrain rates if we were not to have adequate budget to fund rate increases.
And this will be an issue, I'm sure it'll come up in finance, but is the state automatically required then to fund it, or would the funding of the increase be subject to the appropriation of the legislature?
Through the chair, you know, there may be wiser minds than me on exactly how the budget process works, the Division of Senior and Disability Services receives an appropriation that covers nursing homes and home and community-based services, and would include both be affected by both the rates we pay and the people we serve. So if there is some constraint in our budget and we don't and we would have to by statute give a rate increase, then essentially something else would have to give, the number of people we served, some of the service limitations, something like that.
So if I may, on a final point then, and thank you, Madam Chair. So you are not required to provide service to everyone who applies. So you could come, if you were budget constrained, you could cut back on the number of clients that were served?
Through the chair, Medicaid waiver services are subject to, we are not required to serve everyone who's eligible. We essentially tell the federal government how many people we're going to serve, and that sets a limit on how many people we have to serve. So we can constrain that. We can't necessarily constrain directly the number of people served by personal care, although we could change the eligibility criteria for what who would be qualified to receive personal care services. But there are some ways to constrain the number of people served, in, especially in the waiver program.
If you would allow me, that just raises one more further question, if I may.
Yes.
Have we traditionally seen line items for these kind of services show up in the supplemental budget then?
Through the chair, I would have to get back to you. I don't recall.
All right. That's a subject for another committee. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Sherwood, thank you for working with the committee on this legislation. And we've gone quite a ways down the road to satisfy the concerns of the department. The legislature always retains. We are the appropriators. We are the branch of government that appropriates. The governor makes proposals. She doesn't really have a budget. She has a budget proposal. And the legislature appropriates the money or doesn't appropriate the money. That was all pretty basic understanding of everyone, that the legislature, if there is a cost-based rate review process on an annual basis, you all will make a proposal to the legislature, and we will either fund or not fund services like we do in many other areas or all other areas. So I just want it clear on the record that the legislature retains its powers of appropriation to appropriate or to refuse to appropriate funds. Mr. Sherwood, it seems to me that cost of providing service would be the logical, a logical element or consideration in setting rates. And I know the department isn't crazy about the idea of saying cost should be a factor in setting the rates, but all logic dictates that cost would be a significant factor in setting of rates. And so I don't think we've gone beyond reason in this legislation. I understand your discomfort with that, for people to argue about what the true cost is, but we're trying to set up a system. I mean, you started that with your consultant to try and figure out a way to get a better handle on this and do a better job. So I appreciate that aspect of things. I appreciate you being uncomfortable with us saying cost-based rates in statute. But ultimately, any system of rate review would consider the cost of providing these services by home and community-based service providers, just like we do with nursing homes, that cost is a significant factor in deciding the rate. What other consideration is there besides the cost? So common sense dictates that we're, understand your concern, but common sense would dictate that we just face that forthrightly. And I appreciate the work that's gone into this report at the end. I know there are other folks in the legislative process that, who have an interest in this legislation, some surprising folks that I thought might resist this legislation who are talking about it in a positive vein as a management tool for the legislature, to not go into home and community-based service costs with our eyes closed or just waiting a decade to give anybody a raise, but to see this as each year you would let us know what the costs are so we could say yes or no or maybe to that request. In a given year or in a given supplemental. So could I get you to comment on the report and how that could be? That's my perspective on things, but I'm interested in your perspective on the report and how that might help the department and help the legislature be better policymakers and budget writers.
Thank you. Through the chair, the report, and I'm glad you asked that question, because I think the report, for us, the department sees it as a vehicle for accountability, to give us a forum by which we can state what we are doing and put it forward and have an open discussion about it. And I think as we were thinking of this idea, one of the things that came to mind for us was the report we do annually for the, I think most people know it as the developmental disabilities wait list, but our progress at working that wait list. And we've had experience where by providing that information to folks and people understanding where we are in the status, we have been able to sustain substantial progress at working and taking people off the wait list or the registry, as we now call it, and putting them into service. And likewise, we thought this report would offer a similar sort of vehicle to come forward to the legislature and have this discussion about where our costs are going and see whether the legislature supported the direction we were going.
Madam Chair, Mr. Sherwood, I really appreciate that, because a lot of times the legislature requires reports back to us. Some of them go read and some of them go unnoticed. And oftentimes departments see it as a hassle or just one more thing that we're piling on your desk of required responsibilities. But I just wanted to establish for the record that you all think it's a good idea, and that hopefully the committee will think it's a good idea, and that it can be a good management tool for all of us.
Thank you. I'd just like to go on record to say that I am a co-sponsor on this bill, and I appreciate the work that's been put into this, but it hasn't gotten me where I think that we need to be as legislators. I do appreciate the fact that Senator Ellis say that we do the appropriation, we will make up our minds as to what we'll put in and what we will not. I have no problem with that. I do have a problem with this two-year delay when we've been waiting for years now for this rate review to be completed so that we could begin to give these people the raises that there are some increase in pay that they need. It's almost on a daily basis somebody is calling about the lack of money that they have to run the programs. And just today when I got back to my office, I had a letter that had come to me saying a rate review had been done to a grantee, and they were told that they would have to take on 4.5 more staff members in order to continue that program, which cost them about $300,000 is what they're saying. And there is no money that we're going to give to help in those kinds of situations. I don't know how we could do those kind of rate reviews and tell people that they have to bring these people on, but we're not willing to say come forward. Is the administration now willing to come forward, even though we're going to do this two-year delay to get on the schedule that you want us to be on? Will there be anything out there saying we believe that we should give some increase, given amount, let us decide what it's going to be, something that will take place in this 90-day session?
Madam Chair, I think our concern with the delayed effective date had to do with having a statutory rate-setting mechanism in place that we could actually move forward and implement and comply with the statute when it became effective. And our experience with our efforts with Myers and Stauffer showed us that we didn't get as far as we wanted to in terms of knowing how to do that rate setting, how to get reasonable cost information from providers in a way that wasn't excessively burdensome to them. And we did not want to put ourselves or providers in the position of having to try and attempt to come into statutory compliance immediately. That said, we do have the department does have the ability through regulations to change rates. And if there is adequate funding in the budget, we can look at changing our rates. But I think we felt that for the purpose of putting in statutory rate provisions, it was important that we didn't set ourselves up from failure by requiring us to comply with the statute where we didn't have a methodology off the shelf ready to go forward.
And I can appreciate that, and I'm not trying to say that the two-year delay is not a good thing to do to get in compliance the way you want it to be, but I still want to hear from you, and you're saying that it can be done. So that leaves the door open that we can come up with some kind of money that we might be able to do a increase in pay now and not 2 years later.
Through the chair, or Madam Chair, excuse me, nothing in this bill would prohibit us from doing a rate increase prior to the implementation of the statute. That would largely be dependent on the available funds in our budget.
All right, thank you. Senator Ellis.
Excellent question. And to Mr. Sherwood, the Hess, as you know, the Hess Finance Subcommittees in the House and Senate are both in the process of meeting and reviewing your budget. What specific line item would need to be increased for a rate adjustment in the near term?
It's our primarily it would be our senior and disability Medicaid services. Also, if you want to increase, through the chair, if you want to increase the amount for assisted living homes paid through our general relief assisted living and adult protective services, I believe that's the community and protection section of the Division of Senior and Disability Service budget.
Would it be too much? I know it would take some time, but would you be willing to provide this committee with information of what those lines in your budget would need to increase for, well, I don't want to pick a number, but.
I'm going to let them.
For some sort, yeah, if you could give us a some options for a rate increase in those two lines of your budget, the amount of money that would need to be appropriated for some sort of reasonable increase in the near term. And then this committee could forward that on to the Hess Finance Subcommittees for consideration. Maybe two or three options. If you give us this amount of money, the rates would go up for this many providers, or the covered providers by this amount.
Through the chair, I believe we can probably provide that information to you. Okay.
So. Thank you very much. Senator Passman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I understand, while you may have the option of providing care at this level and like personal care services in a recipient's home, but if they had to be institutionalized, what option can you exercise if they're at that category?
Through the chair, Senator Pathfan, I'm not sure I understand your question. If someone is institutionalized and they go into a nursing home or a facility for the developmentally disabled, they're still covered in that same budget component for Medicaid, the Senior and Disability Services Medicaid. They would just be paid for another provider, and those rates are established under the statutory authority in 707-070, which the original bill, that was the section the original bill amended. That section's been, changes to that section have been taken out of the committee substitute. So did I answer your question?
I just want to try to make certain that they might not be covered if they're staying at home, but they have to be covered if they're in an institution?
Through the chair, that's correct. It is a mandatory coverage that we cover individuals in nursing facilities in the institutional setting. And it is either provided through state option for personal care or through our home and community-based waivers, which are essentially a state option. States do not have to offer those waivered services. I think with regard to some of the assisted living services, if Medicaid doesn't cover it, some of it would fall under the adult protection statutes, and so some of it would be covered there at 100% general funds.
And then just, if I may, Madam Chair,
me.
The cost is less if they're through a personal care services if they're in their own home as compared to in an institution.
Through the chair, generally speaking, that's right. I would have to do the math to make sure that it wasn't possible for somebody receiving the maximum amount of personal care to exceed our lowest cost nursing home, but overall, by far, that's, you know, that is the case.
Senator Ellis.
Madam Chair, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sherwood, it is the policy of the state, right, to encourage people to stay in the least restrictive, most cost-effective level of care?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, that's correct. We do attempt to offer people the option of staying out of institutions if that's their choice.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to know if there's anybody in the audience that plan to testify on this piece of legislation. Is there anybody online? Hear none. One other question that I have while you're there. We do not have the PCAs included in here.
Through the chair, Madam Chair, excuse me, that's correct. The PCAs are included now. Personal care services, it's referenced specifically in the statute.
Okay, thank you.
Or the proposed statute.
Yes, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? It was our intent that we thought that we'd be able to move this piece of legislation out. I think that we need further information, and we're going to give the administration time to get some other information back to us so that we can pass that along to the appropriate sub-finance committees. And the next place that it will go would be to finance. So we're going to hold the bill for today. Anybody have any objections to that? Hearing none, we'll just close out Senate Bill 32, CS 32.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We have one other bill coming before us, the Senate Bill 52. Senator Terrio is here, and he's ready to present his bill again.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. The legislation that you have before you is a reintroduction of legislation that was considered previously that would move to place Salvia divinorum, which is a very powerful hallucinogenic substance, onto our controlled substance list. It is primarily grown in the mountainous regions of Mexico. It has a history of use as a vision-inducing substance by the Aztec Indians of the region. Because it is so easy to misuse and can produce long-term psychological effects, it has been banned in several countries and is being banned in numerous states, a growing number of states across the nation. The leaves of this perennial herb, once processed, can be eaten, can be drunk as tea or consumed in a tea form or inhaled. It is presently available to persons in Alaska who choose to order it over the internet. And although the purchases of the substance that do order over the internet are asked if they are 18 years of age or older, we know that those kinds of restrictions are very loosely applied. The sellers and their websites promise that it will produce mind-altering experiences, but experts have warned us that depression and schizophrenia are very real risks from this drug. Now, I've had some criticism for the introduction of the legislation over the last couple of years that if we don't, in fact, want our young people in the state to know about this drug, then we shouldn't introduce legislation and have any kind of headlines. And I think that pretends that the word doesn't spread as it does over the internet, over Facebook and MySpace sites. That our young people go to. As with all items that enter into our pulp culture, drug culture, salvia is enjoying a rise in use due to the powerful aspects of its use And what I'm asking us to consider today is that we follow the lead of many countries and other states and put this onto our list of controlled substances that would list it right along with peyote,
mescaline,
and mescaline,
and LSD,
and also LSD. So with that, Madam Chairman, I'm here to answer questions, or Mr. Stancliffe, who's done a lot of the research on this for me, he can perhaps answer questions if I'm not able to.
All right, thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Terrio, thanks for being with us today. What's your response to the religious freedom argument that some folks have made to the committee? And then how would you answer I don't know if it's the Alaska Libertarian Party or members of the Alaska Libertarian Party testified at the last meeting and have been contacting legislators from the personal freedom of adults aspect of the legislation. So could you address the religious freedom and the libertarians organizing against the bill?
Well, Senator, I guess for myself, I would say from the libertarian perspective, while I tend to agree with them on many things, I don't know when this is of the same in the same category as mescaline and LSD. We don't give people the freedom just to order that over the internet and use it, you know, exercise their own free will to use those drugs. We have realized as a society that there are certain substances that the damage to the individual and to society as a whole is great enough that we put restrictions on it, and so that's what we're asking here. I'm not sure that the connection with a religious ceremony is any different than peyote, and again, we have put that onto our controlled substance list. So I would guess that if scheduling this drug causes us a problem, we've already got that problem with the drugs that we've already listed. Yet I don't hear people coming to us to asking for legislation to be introduced to remove the restriction on those other drugs.
If I may?
Yes, Senator Pasvak?
Have you asked the Alaska Medical Association, or has the American Medical Association produced any type of study that puts this particular drug in a specific category?
Madam Chairman, thank you. I have looked into that.
State your name for the record,
yes,
please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. Dave Stancliffe, staff to Senator Terrio. There has been a fair amount of debate as to how this substance reacts with the mind, and it is unique in all other hallucinogenics. And so there has also been some further research with regard to how it might be used carefully and medically to alleviate symptoms that other drugs might have caused in an individual's psychic behavior. There's ongoing studies in both of those organizations, and this bill does not preclude in any way the use of this substance for such studies or for if it were to be categorized as a medicinal substance of worth. This bill would not prohibit that, Senator.
Yes, you might.
You use the term in here of misuse, and that's what I'm trying to find out is what's the difference in any of these studies between what might be an appropriate use and what might be an inappropriate misuse.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Senator Pasquin. My research has revealed that young people, first of all, there's no quality control on the substance whatsoever. So what they say, and you can buy it right down in the street here at the smoke shop, purple sticky salvia, you have no idea when you get it over the internet, which is another big route into Alaska, what you're getting. And the other thing that makes this substance so, dangerous is that in the chat rooms where adults who constantly experiment with other types of psychic substances say that they have not found a level that is predictable each and every time. In other words, they might take an amount one time and have one reaction and take what they think is the same amount the next time have an entirely different reaction. And since this is so much more powerful than any other natural hallucinogenic substance, it takes very, very little, millionths of a gram, to induce a trance put people into a catatonic state if they overdose at all. Even the most experienced mind travelers, and that's part of the sect that really experiment with these types of substances, warn time and time and time again about this particular substance. And it's not just warning the youth. So there is medically at this point no way to measure and determine effects in any type of routine situation.
One last
yes,
question. I assume then that this wants to make those that use it felons.
It would
compared to, you know, creating an infraction as compared to making it a misdemeanor, or if, you know, the marijuana issue, if you have below a certain quantity, you know what I'm, why is it classified as a felon as compared to something else?
Madam Chairman, in some states it's put on the Schedule 1. We've elected Schedule 2 because it seems to have the same type of difficult properties that those other substances have. And I think that we will probably hear from people within the administration who may speak to exactly how the Schedule 2 works in terms of the degrees of, criminality that are involved as you misuse those substances. Certainly it is no less dangerous, and probably in many cases far more dangerous than mescaline, LSD, peyote, and that's the experiences you'll see on YouTube and also in the chat sites. It might be worth putting on record, Madam Chairman, that since Senator Terrio began this effort 3 years ago, and there was one place that we knew of where you could obtain this at a smoke shop, that it, since that time, it has escalated to the point where smoke shops all over the state are carrying it. So it's safe to assume that there's a market. Also, where there were only 20 or so YouTube sites to go and view the results of the use of this drug, there's now 4,600. Young people like to entertain themselves by showing each other how they react to this drug. I can guarantee you, I can give you 3 sites that if you were to go to and see, you would learn all you need to know about this particular substance in about 10 or 12 minutes. It's a very scary substance.
I guess if I may.
Yes, you may.
That's what I'm struggling with, is this concept of felony versus misdemeanor versus an infraction for something that I haven't heard, the AMA, whether it's the Alaska Medical or the American Medical Association, has come out with a definitive statement on that Alaska's a policy should make it a felony. That I'm struggling with that.
Madam Chairman, I understand the question, and I don't think there's anywhere in writing that I've discovered that those organizations would comment on what degree of criminality this particular substance should receive.
Senator Terrio.
Yes, Madam Chairman. And so what we're left with is making a comparison to the other drugs that we've already listed and trying to match it up with, is it of the same category with the same downside? And that's why we've suggested that it be placed in our existing listing structure where we have.
Madam Chairman, it might be useful here. The Navy's Drug Detention and Deterrence Branch quotes as follows, states as follows, there's been recent interest in young adults and adolescents to rediscover ethnobotanical plants that can induce changes in perceptions, hallucinations, and other psychologically induced changes. Information provided by abusers indicates that the negative long-term effects of Salvia divinorum may be similar to those produced by other hallucinogenics such as LSD, including depression and schizophrenia. And the DEA's quote is, it's a drug of concern because of its wide availability and unknown long-term effects, but it's dangerous, DEA spokeswoman Rogine Waite said. Just because it's not a controlled substance, people should not think it's okay to use. And that matches up with users' comments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did go to YouTube and did the search and watched some of the videos and have no doubt that it's a negative or, you know, can be an impactful substance. Do we, and we are the HES committee, or the Health and Social Services Committee, is there anything to include in the packet about the health impacts of the substance to sort of justify illegalizing it? I mean, I'm convinced that it's, you know, for me, I would say it's not a healthy substance and has a negative health impact. But I think we probably need to document that a little more than just each of our reactions to the scary videos.
Thank you, Senator Ellis. I think as Mr. Stancliffe indicated, though, certainly if placing it on the controlled substance list is just that, it's a controlled substance. If there was a documentable health benefit, it could be prescribed, but it's controlled, just like many of medications that certainly the pharmaceutical companies determine have a beneficial use, but not uncontrolled in our society. It's something that you have to get a prescription for. I'm not aware of, nor do I think Mr. Stancliffe has come across any kind of scientific research that shows that they have determined a specific use. But if that were to be determined in the future, the placing of the substance on this list would not preclude its use. So, and Madam Chairman, one other thing I just wanted to point out, we do have a letter, and I'm not sure if there's somebody here to testify today from the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and the Mental Health Board today. We did get a letter of support or offering their support for the legislation.
All right, I will check to see if there's anybody online or in the audience that's here to speak to that. My concern is not, this bill has two other committees to go to, judiciary as well as finance. Some of the issues that's been brought up would be dealt with in judiciary and not in this particular committee. I do believe if there was some concern from the health side of it, somebody would be here to speak to that. Is there anybody from the administration that's here that's willing to answer questions or to speak to this bill? I guess it's not. And this is not the first time we've heard this bill. We've heard this bill at least through two committees I was served on last year.
That's correct.
So this bill is coming back before, so it's not new to us. I don't know what the committee is willing to do at this point. I will see if there's anybody that have not already testified. I have names of several people that testified before, but I'm looking for people that have not testified. Is there anybody in the audience that want to testify that haven't already testified at the last hearing? Is there anybody on line that would like to testify that have not testified? I don't hear anyone saying that they are. I would like to know what the wishes of the committee is on this bill. Or do you want to have further discussion? Yes, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I move that we move the bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
Any objection?
Madam Chair, I have no objection. I'll be signing the report, no recommendation.
Right, it's, he said with individual recommendations, mm-hmm.
I just wanted to let you know.
I'm going to go on record. Yes, that's not a problem.
I won't object to advancement. I just think there are a few more things to address before.
Yes, and if there's anybody object and want to call the roll, we will do that also. So hearing no objection, then we will move this bill out of HES committee to the next committee of referral.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is that it for today?
That completes our agenda for today. And with that, we will adjourn at 2:25.